Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So who had Rich Strike in the Derby? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Who saw that coming?
Rarely comment on horse racing, but when an 80-1 shot comes in.
It's a pretty big deal, right, Dan?
Pair some commentary. I love this story because it just speaks to a couple of things that are going on in culture generally. One is the experts. Two is this idea that I don't have to participate in life because I'm going to prognosticate instead. I'm a prognosticator. Okay. I'm not a doer. Here's what's going to happen, so it absolves me of any responsibility to be impactful. We see this in politics all the time. Oh, this person is going to win. Oh, that race is over. Oh, this thing is done. And as we see on Saturday, that in life, spoils go to the doer, not the prognosticator.
Zozos is next after 3 quarters in 1:10.45 seconds. And now Epicenter comes splitting horses.
You don't want to hear it?
Quickly,
it's
as
great.
Crown Pride takes the lead around the far turn.
Fine, but I mean, it was such a surprise.
You're
going
to replay the whole race?
Yeah, yeah, how about 49 seconds, they're coming around the final turn. Yeah,
how about you do your own Phil Georgeff and we'll call it a day?
Well, all of a sudden he's like, Rich, right? What? Holy, you know what he wanted to say, holy, whatever, but he just said holy. Oh, my God, he won the race.
Yeah, he was picked up last fall, as I understand it, in a claims race for $30,000. So,
I mean, look at, how is that possible?
You have all the Bob Baffords of the world, you know, the rich and the wired in, and then these guys come in with some $30,000 horse and win the Derby. I mean, it's just a great story. This is why underdog stories are so fun. This is why they play the games. They don't just rely on prognosticators to determine the outcome. And it also reminds me, there's a great movie out right now.
Yeah.
Or I think it came out a bit ago called The Jockey. Or I think it may just be Jockey. But anyway, it's Clifton. It's sort of like Seabiscuit, where, in all great sports movies, where the sport or the contest, the competition, is sort of the backdrop, but it's not really the point of the story. The point of the story is the camaraderie or the dynamic between the characters within that particular sport or arena. It's Clifton Collins is the protagonist, and he, you may not know the name, but you will know the face when you see him because he's a character actor and there's been a bunch of stuff. And the movie is shot like a Terrence Malick film.
Oh,
like Tree of Life, where the natural landscape is a character in the film. And it's got a father and son element, too. So if you're looking for a good movie to download off Amazon, I think it is, then, you know, the Jockey. And then you can rewatch the Kentucky Derby after that and pretend Clifton Collins is writing Rich Strike or something. I don't know. But it's just interesting.
He was in 16th place coming around the final turn.
Well, right. That's where 80-1 shots usually are.
How much money did it? All right. So if you bought a ticket for $1. Oh, here, Mike, you can do the math.
Oh boy.
Oh, here comes Mike Scott.
Yeah. Don't rely on me on math. $1 turned into $163.60.
Oh, that's awesome. Mm-hmm.
If the reporting is correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Easy money.
Easy money if you've got the guts to bet an 80-1 shot.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy talking about the Derby upset, greatest, second greatest long shot in Derby history, I think.
Well, what was the first one?
I'll Google it. I don't know that much horse racing trivia, just a little bit.
Mike knows. Mike Scott is saddling up, folks.
Who's the last horse to win the Triple Crown? Affirmed?
No. Recently.
Oh, yeah.
Last 5 years.
Yeah, right.
Before
that, it was Affirmed, though, in 78.
Yeah, 78.
Right? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Donna Rail in 1918 was at 84-1 odds last time.
Oh, I remember that really
well.
Yeah,
you, well.
I mean, I wasn't diapers
speak
back then.
Speak for yourself. I do not remember that. But, yeah, Donna Rail was 84-1.
Okay.
Rick and Carol Stream, did your wife have Donna Rail in 1915?
No, not that old.
All right.
You won't say that anyway.
Yeah, okay.
We bet $6. We almost bet 14, but I misread the machine, and I thought I had $6 left, and I had 14 left. But we bet $6. She won $4.75.
Very nice.
Wow,
congratulations. I noticed you say
that. It would have been $1,200 if we played the whole.
I noticed that you say that we bet $6 and she won $4.75. Yeah, interesting.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mother's Day weekend. Good for you.
Oh, that's
true. Good move.
Thanks, Rick. Congratulations. John Piatone.
Hello. I think the horse you were trying to think of is California Chrome a few years ago. The rich folks
were
going up against a...
Oh, California. Oh, yeah, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and... wouldn't you know that one of the competitors actually ran into that horse and injured its hock, and it couldn't finish the race. So that was the end of that. So that, I was surprised they didn't come up on charges for that done purposely.
All right. Thanks for the call, John. Appreciate it. Justify? Was that the last Triple Crown winner? Do I have that right? Don't we have Triple Crown aficionados or horse racing aficionados? I know we have degenerate gamblers in the listening audience.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
Somebody has to know this. It recalls another great horse race past.
Mm-hmm.
This one, of course, you'll remember this. This is a famous call.
They're off in the Christmas COVID handicap hurdle. And first to show is Omicron Lad.
Oh,
Omicron Lad being closely followed by the Booster. The Booster. Omicron Lad. In a bit of an early race here with each other, the Booster and Omicron Lad. Antigen test trying to get in there. Antigen test, Omicron Lad, the Booster. Track and Trace trying to get a look in, but he looks to be struggling early doors, I'm afraid. Track and Trace. Antigen test on the outside. Here comes HEPA filters. HEPA filters. Being followed by the Booster.
Oh,
Omicron
yeah.
Lad. Omicron Lad, the Booster. Omicron Lad not giving an inch to the Booster. HEPA filters. Here comes New Year's Eve, absolutely cruising on the outside. Everybody talking about this one, New Year's Eve, looking confident and assured. The Booster, Omicron Lad, HEPA filters, Track and Trace is knackered, he's gone. New Year's Eve is coming fast. Sudden spike, sudden spike appears out of nowhere. Sudden spike, the big danger, New Year's Eve, the Booster plugging away gamely with Omicron Lad, New Year's Eve, sudden spike, here comes Leave Them Kids Alone, Leave Them Kids Alone.
That's
sudden
my horse.
Spike, New Year's Eve, and a late challenge from It's Only a Cold, It's Only a Cold, sudden spike, Leave Them Kids Alone, the Booster, Fork Dose. Nobody saw this one coming. Fork Dose out of nowhere. It's only a cold. Fork Dose. It's only a cold. Leave them kids alone. Fork Dose. It's only a cold. Oh, I have no idea how they're going to sort this one out, to be honest with you. They all crossed the line together. New Year's Eve just crossing the line now, absolutely spent. And Track and Trace is still running, would you believe? Happy Christmas.
Yeah, that's a classic call. Sudden Spike, that is a good horse's name.
Spike, yeah, that would work.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
morning, Dan and Amy, and we're pleased to be joined again by our friend Iran Tillis. He is the founder, creator of 120 Life, which I've been speaking about for many months now. 120life.com, that 8-ounce juice drink that keeps my blood pressure right where you need it to be. And by the way, Amy, the blood pressure lobby is really exercising its, pressure. May is National High Blood Pressure Education Month. Good. Did you know that?
Right, because a lot of strokes are associated with high blood pressure. So you want to got to keep it in check. Like, I have high blood pressure and I take medicine every day for it.
Well, you got to get on the 120 Life.
I know.
That's what you're not doing. Aaron Tillis, we digress over here, but thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's great to have you. Wait,
are you responsible for National High Blood Pressure Education Month? Is that you're doing as well?
I am not, but I do spread the message, so to speak.
Well, what is the message? What is the message on high blood pressure vis-a-vis your creation, 120 Life?
Well, I think the message is overall, and especially for people over, let's say, 40 or 45, that you have to know what your blood pressure numbers are, and there's no reason that you should not. You could find out at a doctor's office. You could find out
at
a pharmacy.
Yeah.
You could probably invest, I don't know exactly the price today, maybe $30 and get something at your house, because if you know, you can fix it. You could help a lot. If you don't know, then that's why they call it the silent killer. Because many times, even my father, walking down the street and had a massive stroke, unaware, he was a pharmacist, that he had high blood pressure. So I think the answer is know your numbers. If you leave here with one thing I say today, it's that. Because if you know what they are, then you can go to your doctor and talk about what you can do.
And well, how does 120 Life help with blood pressure?
So, 120 Life, and as we were just talking about, my life really has been about music. I write and produce music, and so my blood pressure went really high, as I've talked about, and they gave me 3 weeks. Dr. Lowell Steen from Loyola said 3 weeks or we're going to have to do surgery because I had another pre-existing condition. So immediately I was like, what do you eat? What do you drink? And I realized that there were no drinks, none, like zero, on the market for people with high blood pressure. And I had been reading about four or five, six things that they sort of looked alike. I'm like, okay, cranberry juice looks like tart cherry juice, looks like hibiscus tea, looks like beet juice. And and I'm reading the studies. I thought, wow, I'll just go buy it, assuming somebody had put them all together. And nobody had. And I thought, well, it can't be that hard. And off I went and created what is the number one drink and the first drink really on the market for people with high blood pressure.
And what about when people say, well, if I have a high blood pressure issue, I'll just go to my doctor and get a prescription.
Yeah, and exactly right. And I'm going to actually use his name. So I got a call from one of your listeners yesterday. His name is Charles Smith.
Okay.
Great guy. And he left me a voicemail. I can play you the voicemail. And he said, I've been drinking 120. My blood pressure dropped from 174 to 135. And he said, I don't want to be on medication because I don't like how it makes me feel and the side effects. And I think many people feel the same way. Not maybe 100% of your audience, but some people feel the medication has side effects that they don't want to deal with. So our drink is all natural. It's a possibility of one solution to maybe help you.
Talk to us about some other blood pressure myths, just as people get sort of a working knowledge of blood pressure and 120 Life and the impact, the things they should be thinking about. Know your numbers first and foremost, but then from there.
So my everyone that calls and I talk to, and again, many of your listeners, I say the first thing you must do is cut your salt. And their response is always, because this is a little bit of a myth, well, I don't put salt on my food. And I say, well, exactly. We know many people are not doing that, but everything you have, or most things you have salt or sodium. And sodium is a big problem for people with high blood pressure, or can cause it. And here's why, real fast, that sodium is attracted to water. So if you're having excess salt in your diet, that means water is staying in your system that should not be there. And that's what everything gets backed up. So this excess water is causing issues on your heart, and then it could lead to strokes and things like that. So how do you cut your sodium? And I always say five words: control what you can control. So if you're going out to dinner, family, friends, almost impossible. You're not going to go in the kitchen and watch how much sodium they're putting in your food. But if you're home, you can do basic things. Fruit, bananas, blueberries, no sodium, apples, no sodium. Now, it doesn't taste as good, but what about snacks without salt? Because the first thing I do when I go home is I go to the cabinet. And my wife knows, okay, go buy wherever you're going to buy it. If you're going to have cashews or almonds or pretzels, no salt. It doesn't taste as good. And somebody called me yesterday, said, I was laughing. She said, I threw out my oatmeal because I heard you talking about oatmeal. And I read the amount of sodium in oatmeal. I realized it was excessive. And I'm like, well, don't throw it out. But the next time you go, buy steel cut oatmeal. Zero amount, zero. So if you're at home, between the oatmeal, some fruit, and some salt-free snacks, you could cut maybe 500, 600, 700 milligrams of salt a day. And people are like, well, that's not that much. Now I'm like, well, do the math. Okay, over a year, that's 200,000 milligrams. 200,000 milligrams of salt not going in your body.
What has a lot of salt is soup. And now you can buy soup with less sodium.
Exactly.
And also, too, if you order french fries, you can ask for a special order without salt on it.
Right. I think as
unsolicited
society,
advice,
we're becoming aware of exactly of things we can do. And nobody's going to be perfect, but I'm like, control what you can control.
He is Ira Antelis. He is the creator of 120 Life, 120life.com. The best way for people to try 120 Life, Ira?
Sure. If you go to 120life.com, you can order online. And the thing that you have to know is if you're unhappy for any reason, I'll give you your money back. And I'm the one who you talk to. Many of your listeners, wonderful people, will call me. And so if you're unhappy, I'll just give you your money back. But if it works, all of a sudden your blood pressure numbers, like Charles Smith, can go down. And if it doesn't work, then just call me and I'll give you your money back. No questions asked.
Pretty simple. 120life.com is the website. Get you, it's a two-week trial pack if you want. Do it that way, and that's your entry into the program. See if it works for you. Ira Antelis. Ira, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Have a great day. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, so that robbery and shooting of a 23-year-old subsequently identified as Dakota Early last week went viral. This happened in Lincoln Park. He was preyed upon by a guy who pulled up and was waiting for him. This is at like 2 a.m. in the morning, waiting for him as he crossed the street. He jumped him, took his cell phone, and then shot him.
Yeah, because he wanted the passcode to his cell phone.
And shot him twice at point-blank range. It's incredible and that he's still alive. But yesterday, CWB Chicago had it, that his family was saying he's on life support. We are not and will not lose hope or faith for Dakota. And there's a GoFundMe set up, too, as well. Donations nearing $41,000 as of Saturday evening.
I mean, have you seen the video? It is gut-wrenching. And there's sound where he's, you know, he's like, oh, no, no, begging for his life. And they go up and just shoot him again at point blank range. Monsters. And I mean, this happened at Wayne and Webster in Lincoln Park. No one's safe anytime during the day because there were shootings over the weekend.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, like in broad daylight. And then this happened at 3:05 in the morning. But it's just, it's a war zone out there. I'm telling you, nobody is safe from this.
Dakota Early, again, is his name, a 23-year-old culinary student shot three times in Lincoln Park on Friday. Life support remains in critical condition. And the family said in an update on Saturday, we've been informed his left leg has too much blood pumping, which may require an amputation if it does not slow down. He lost part of his colon, will also lose part of his jaw where one of the gunshots went through, but they are not losing hope or faith, so they say. And again, that GoFundMe page is set up. I don't know. I don't know if people are just completely desensitized to it. I know people were talking about it. I know the video, because there's video of it. There's police cam video of it, you know, the cop in a box video of it, that it resonated, but then it's quickly forgotten, I suppose. This is also against the backdrop of the expansion of private police patrols in Chicago neighborhoods. Private patrols now monitoring Bucktown, Lincoln Park, Lakeview, and West Loop.
Oh.
West Loop businesses and neighbors have hired a private security firm. And again, this is just observe and report type security, maybe one step above Paul Blart Mall Cop. Jim Higgins, who opened Club Lucky in 1990, Club Lucky, anybody knows the Chicago knows Club Lucky. It's an institution in Bucktown. It's a question of having more people looking out for each other, said Higgins. It's just a challenge all over Chicagoland right now. It's just trying to keep everybody safe and keep the awareness up. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And who's paying for all this?
They are.
They are.
And Triple Threat swinging her joint around saying the same thing she said when this idea first was spawned in Bucktown. And now, again, other neighborhoods looking at it and replicating it. She said, we can't have a situation where public safety is only available to the wealthy. It's such a remarkable statement for her to make. Really. We can't have a situation where public safety is only available to the wealthy. The mayor says in response to business owners and residents of particular neighborhoods coming together to provide the resources to hire private security to augment any police presence they enjoy. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Can't have a situation where public safety is only available to the wealthy. Do you agree we should be very skeptical of these private security patrols? It's not appropriate. It provides a division in this one Chicago that is so otherwise unified.
Well, I remember during the George Floyd riots downtown, there's a very exclusive elite senior living center, and they had their own armed security guards, but they had long guns. And I remember I was talking to them because they were, you know, wearing fatigues, and they said, no, we were hired by this firm, you know, or this company, and we're standing outside because the lady from the Chamber of Commerce came up and asked them who they were and what they're doing, and that, you know, they're scaring people, tourists who are walking by, and they said, we're here to protect the people in this building, and that is what we're doing.
And?
No, I think it's great. I mean, if they can afford it and they want to do it, do it. That's their right. Because there's not, you know, police are spread thin. And don't forget, we still have that vaccine mandate out there for the police officers, so the thousands more could be off the streets. They're taking them down slowly, folks. That's still in line. And I think it's none of her business. I mean, she can't protect us, and we're paying tax dollars to be protected. So if you have the money, do it.
Cannot have a situation, quote, cannot have a situation where public safety is only available to the wealthy, unquote. That's what the mayor said.
She's so over her skis.
The security firm, the principal of this, or executive vice president of the security firm, P4 Security Solutions, explaining that we do more than just look out for bad guys. We're calling 311 if we see graffiti in a garage. We notify the neighbors if there's a garage door open. We call the city if we see trim limbs that are down, sort of a broken windows approach. Yeah. We're putting off-duty police officers that are providing these safety patrols, either retired or active, and we feel that's the highest level of security you can provide when you're doing this type of patrol. The data we've seen in the areas we're patrolling, we've reduced the frequency of crime dramatically compared to the surrounding areas that are nearby. Well, that sounds nice, but we cannot have a situation where public safety is only available to the wealthy. You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the pronouncements we hear about the Chicago public school system. We cannot let a child escape the Chicago public school system. Because the schools need to be, well, they'll say properly funded. Schools need to be as good as the private schools. Yeah. We shouldn't have a divide between the wealthy who can afford private schools and those that are, they wouldn't say this, but I'll say it, relegated to the neighborhood schools. I mean, that's essentially what they're saying without saying it. It's not right. Do you see the rhetorical game they run here? Cannot have two different systems, one for the wealthy and one for everybody else. Who's in charge of the one for everybody else? Mike and Niles.
Hey, Dan, love your show. I'm a retired Chicago police officer, and this just gets me insane because if you look at the numbers of the police officers assigned to the 16th and the 17th district, which are the far northwest side districts, like bordering Niles, Park Ridge, Norwich, Harwood Heights, the numbers are minute compared to the 11th, the 7th. All the resources on the Chicago from the Chicago Police Department are assigned to the west and the south side. Now they're starting to realize, well, we got to start sending coppers downtown. They don't know what to do at this point anymore. But for her to say that, oh, we can only, you know, it shouldn't be only, you know, public safety shouldn't be afforded to only those who can. Where are all the resources at? All the coppers are assigned to these districts, which are busy districts, and I'm not taking that away from them, but I mean, for her to even have the audacity to say this, it's disgusting at this point. It's getting to the point where it's like surreal what's going on in the city. No, like you're saying, no one's safe anymore. It doesn't matter where you're at.
Yep.
Yeah.
And she also says, Mike, they don't have the authority to patrol our streets.
Yeah, they concede that point. Yeah. They're not pretending to be police officers. They're not pretending to be police. They're describing exactly what they're going to do as part of their contractual arrangement with the people that hired them. And also, too, it's this whole thing. Hey, what are the proles doing? They're organizing. They're providing services for themselves. Hey, that's our job. Don't tread on our turf, even if we're not keeping our turf safe. That's essentially the attitude, and that's the government-centric attitude you have in a failed kleptocratic city like Chicago.
And also the group hired, the Bucktown group, they're off-duty police officers.
Right.
So, you know.
Retired.
And she knows that because I was at one of the press conferences. Like, 95% of them are off-duty or recently retired police officers.
This is an opportunity not to talk.
They know the streets. They know the neighborhoods.
It's an opportunity not to talk about public safety, which is what an adult would do. What a cynical political demagogue would do is use this as an opportunity to play identitarian politics. You know, a sop to those who don't have the wealth to hire private security and use this as an opportunity to further divide, which is what Triple Threat did.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, mostly peaceful. Mostly peaceful protests by pro-aborts over the weekend, like those outside St. Pat's in New York.
Thank God for abortion! Thank God for abortion! Thank God for abortion! Thank God for abortion! Thank God.
And those in front of the homes of Justice Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh.
Abortion, safe, and legal.
Here's what one protester who went to the homes of Roberts and Kavanaugh had to say, explaining why she did.
And what's your name, ma'am?
Nikki Enfield.
And why are you here today?
This is bullshit. you don't get to take away our bodily autonomy and enjoy your Saturday night at home. You get to do one or the other.
And what does it mean to you to be marching to the justices' homes?
This is personal, so we're going to take it to the personal space.
Okay.
They did this, not us.
She's lovely.
Yeah, she is.
Another reason why Dan Proft is single. Well, I don't think you hang out with people like that, though.
No, I don't think I would. No. Don't think I would. Wouldn't be popping for dinner for...
for that thing.
That lovely flower. Mostly peaceful. Had a few hiccups, like the effort to burn down the Wisconsin Right to Life office in Madison with the message, if abortions aren't safe, then you aren't either.
That's a clear threat.
Well, the lighting of the fire, too.
Well, that's right. The arson, yeah. But then they had to leave that little ditty.
We needed one of those MSNBC reporters out there saying it's mostly peaceful with the building on fire behind him.
Oh, yeah. And that made the C block last night on Nightly News, by the way. Mm-hmm. Just a 10-second clip of showing the office that was all charred.
Well, you can understand why they're upset, the pro boards, because as the dizzying intellect that is Amy Klobuchar, Democrat Socialist Senator from Minnesota, Alito is taking us back not to 1972.
Where are we going now?
Well, we're going way back.
In a leaked opinion where Justice Alito is literally not just taking us back to the 1950s, he's taking us back to the 1850s. Oh. He actually cites the fact that abortion was criminalized back when the 14th Amendment was adopted.
Senator, should this be the principal issue?
Really extreme thought.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
I have two comments, just on the extreme thought. She's so funny, Klobuchar, as most of these politicians are. They're so uninteresting and so lacking in thoughtfulness. And I don't know, maybe they don't even understand what they're saying. Maybe they do, and they just have to, they feel they have to speak at this level to feed their base. I don't know. But so extreme, taking us back to 1850s when the, well, actually the 14th Amendment was 1865. But anyway, taking us back to the 1850s. Such an extreme thought. Wait, so the drafters of the 14th Amendment, which I believe, equal protection, I believe she supports. I don't know if she's calling for a repeal of it, but those drafters were extremists. I think Alito's point was to say that the penumbras and emanations that Blackmun found aren't there. And all you do is you go back and look at the attitudes of those who drafted the 14th Amendment, and it supports that claim. And she's like a former prosecutor.
Right.
I mean, it's stunning. You understand why we have lawlessness and disorder. You understand why we have a declining confidence in the justice system in this country. Is because you've had prosecutors like Amy Klobuchar for a long time. This isn't just the recent lineup of Soros-funded prosecutors around the country. You've had these goofs in important positions applying in terms of application of the law in the justice system for a long time. By the way, also this extremism thing, I mean, not to go, you know, full Barry Goldwater here, extremism in the defense of vice is no virtue, moderation in the pursuit of extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice, moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue. It's all extremist. Extremist is the label you offer up when you don't have an argument to make or you don't want to. I don't have to make an argument. I don't have to present any logical threat. I don't have to support my claim because you're an extremist. Dismissed.
Okay. It's speaking of extreme, did you see the signs people were carrying? F God, F your God, and then a picture, you know, of the Milwaukee skyline. I'm a person, effing crazy, I know. An abortion saved my family.
That's not extremism.
Well, I'm just saying
that's ignorance.
Well, it was disgusting.
In his latest Bloomberg column, Tyler Cohen, calling something extremist is not an effective critique. It's a sign that the writer or speaker either doesn't want to take the trouble to make a real argument or is hoping to win the debate through rhetoric or Twitter pressure rather than logic. Right. He goes on, I favor plenty of extremist ideas. For instance, I think the world's major cities should adopt congestion rush hour pricing. Like London and Singapore or some version of it. I also favor human challenge trials. Arguably an even more extreme idea. In human challenge trials, rather than waiting for a virus to infect those vaccinated randomly with a placebo, scientists recruit volunteers and infect them deliberately and immediately. We actually talked about this during COVID. It accelerates the speed of a biomedical trial. But to many people, it's just repugnant and asking for volunteers and is it socioeconomically representative and all these legitimate medical ethics issues that have to be discussed. But these are the extreme ideas. Am I an extremist? Tyler Cohen, not an extremist. But that's what you get. And so I don't like using that word. It's words of the left. And if we use their language, we pollute the language. We pollute people's minds. We obfuscate real debate.
Well, there's going to be a vote taken Wednesday that still needs 60 votes that Lindsey Graham's talking about.
My Democratic friends are trying to pass a law Wednesday that will allow abortion right up to the day before the baby's delivered. Different states will take different approaches. So the abortion debate will not go away in the country. It will be decided by the people, not a handful of judges.
Nancy Pelosi on Mother's Day. Oh, I'm sorry. Parenting People Day. That this is so hard that this memo was leaked right on Mother's Day weekend.
Here we are on Mother's Day, a week where the court has slapped women in the face in terms of disrespect for their judgment about the size and timing of their families. So the fact is, let's keep our eye on the ball. The ball is in the court.
So do you still want to call a truce on moral issues? Don't want to talk about it. You know, I've noticed in reaction to the leaking of the Alito opinion in the Dobbs case, the draft opinion, I noticed a lot in Illinois, the news coverage of it, I noticed a lot of pro-abort Democrat socialists weighed in. Legislators, obviously Jelly Belly.
Oh, yeah.
Triple Threat.
Triple Threat's going to have a news conference today to talk about.
I noticed that, obviously. What about Republicans? Where were the Republicans? Did your Republican state legislator weigh in? If not, why not? Do you want to hold them accountable?
At least put something on social media if the mainstream media doesn't interview you.
People complain to me about being fatalistic about Illinois. What are we going to do here? I don't know. What are you doing? Where's your Republican legislator, especially those that put that pro-life as a bullet point on the mailers about this time of year, especially if they have a primary, or they tell you they're pro-life to make sure you get out and vote for them in a general election, the Democrats, against the Democrats. So have your legislators, if anybody has a state rep or state senator, Republican, that's taken a position that's reacted to the leaking of the Dobbs draft opinion, please do let me know. Because I don't have to look very far to hear from all sorts of pro-abort Democrat socialists. What about those so-called pro-life Republicans in the suburbs? Where are you?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Contrast that from President Trump in Pennsylvania over the weekend for one of his signature rallies. And here's what he had to say about Republicans versus Democrats.
Away from you. If you want to make our country safer for violent criminals, vote for the radical Democrats. If you want to make it safer for your family, your children, and for law-abiding Americans, you must vote for Republicans. You must. I don't know if you heard, you know, our party is growing by leaps and bounds with the Hispanics, African Americans, Asian Americans, everybody. The party is a much different party than it was when I started 6 years ago, really. And we have a much different party. We have a party, some people say Trumpism, call it whatever you want. But it is indeed a party of safety, and it's a party of common sense.
It's also a party that, at least when it comes to former President Trump, isn't afraid to take on cultural, moral issues.
With a Republican Congress, we must defend parents' rights. No teacher should ever be allowed to teach transgender to our children without parental consent. We will save our kids, and we will also keep men the hell out of women's sports. In addition, we will get critical race theory out of our schools, out of our military, and out of every part of our federal, state, and local governments. You know, I had done that, and then just about in his first day in office, he wrote an executive office ending it, but we had already done that. It was gone, got rid of all of them. One of our highest priorities will be to crack down on left-wing censorship and restore free speech in America. We don't have free speech. We don't have free speech, and we have a totally crooked press, all of them back there. We will immediately terminate Joe Biden's so-called disinformation governing board. How about that one? Mm-hmm. A chilling and un-American power grab that we will not allow to stand.
I have those same Republican legislators I talked about in your neck of the woods, in Chicagoland, the suburbs mainly, the few that are left. Have you heard them weigh in on any of those issues? Why not? Have you? And if you have, I should say, why not? Don in Maryville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan. Hi, Amy. I am an actual registered Democrat. I voted for Obama in 08, but learned my lesson, and I voted for Trump the first time and second time. That's what real Democrats did. Klobuchar is a progressive or socialist, and almost every one of these so-called Democrat politicians are either socialists, progressives, or Marxists. I haven't seen a single Democrat representative yet.
Mm-hmm. So, but you're sticking it out, are you?
Well, the only way to change the Democrat Party is to stay a registered Democrat, and if they don't put up the candidates that I feel are good enough, a Democrat can vote for a Republican president in the general.
All right, very good. Fair enough. Thanks, Don. Rich, Indian Head Park.
Oh, yes. Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. The last time we talked about this subject, there was a lot of ridiculous statements like abortion is love and abortion saves lives. But the most ridiculous one that I've heard is when there's signs out there is to pray to uphold abortions. That's like saying you're praying to God to uphold abortions. You're praying to say that you're killing his creations. That, talk about an oxymoron. That's really all I have to say.
Thanks for the call, Rich.
Well, the biggest baby butcher in the Midwest, that's what I'm going to call Governor Pritzker. He tweeted out, the government doesn't belong in your doctor's office, period. Oh, really? Your public health mandates came between doctors and their patients for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And don't even get me started on the coerced vaccinations.
The Republican portion of the Combine's choice for governor in the Republican primary is a Democrat named Richard Irvin, who's the mayor of Aurora.
Don't you know? Yeah.
And here's what he had to say about the leaked Dobbs opinion over the weekend when Craig Wall from ABC 7 ambushed him at a restaurant opening in Aurora, because that's the only way you can get to the guy.
Unlike many of his opponents, Irvin would not weigh in on the possibility of the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade.
That's a leaked draft out of the Supreme Court. That's not a final draft. I think it's irresponsible for us to opine and hypothesize on a draft when we don't have the final decisions.
That's an answer.
He and his running mate, who is a Rauner stooge named Avery Bourne. She's a downstate legislator. A lot of people thought she was pro-life.
Yeah, where is she in this?
Because she runs around saying she's pro-life because she's from an area that's conservative and pro-life, and then she falls in with where the meal ticket is, which is what so many of these surrender combine Republicans have done for so long, which is why you have no effective, real Republican Party in this state. You see how that works? So Irvin is an attorney. He's also a candidate for governor, sort of a relevant issue. The incumbent governor, you've heard prattling on about this, as so many politicians on the left. And he takes the position that he doesn't have to take a position. Oh, okay. Because it's a leaked opinion, it's not the final opinion. Okay, well, what do you think about the case? What do you think about overturning Roe v. Wade and sending back to the states just in principle, even if there was not the Dobbs case before the Supreme Court? Oh, it's premature. I'm going to wait to see what happens, then comment on it when it happens, or duck it when it happens, too. It's just useful that I can duck it since it hasn't happened right now. You know who also played that game of no social agenda?
Oh, Bruce Rauner.
Bruce Rauner.
Right.
Does anybody have any memory? I have no social agenda. People, you tell me all the time, oh, he doesn't have any social agenda. He's just going to focus on the economics. You don't get to play it that way.
But his wife had the social agenda.
No, he had the social agenda. He was the governor. He was elected. And it's tiresome for people to keep saying his wife had the social agenda. Yes, his wife is a pro-abort personal PAC fundraiser. He's the governor. His decisions. Stop absolving him of responsibility by saying somehow he was pushed around by his wife. If that's how it happened, that's not interesting. What's interesting is the decisions he made. No social agenda, and the people told me, he's not going to have any social agenda. He's not going to have any social agenda. The other side gets to play, too. What is complicated about this for people in this state, particularly Republicans? The other side does have a social agenda, and they are going to pursue it with Molotov cocktails as needed. And what do you say? I have no comment because I have no social agenda. No, what actually happens is you get captured by the left and you, like Rahner, sign sanctuary state legislation, which he did. And you sign the most pro-abort at the time legislation in the country, a Republican governor with no social agenda. Taxpayer funding of abortion to birth canal. No social agenda. No comment. We're playing it smart. Right. Because if there's one thing we've seen from the Republican Party in Illinois and its leadership over the last 50 years, it's smart. It's electoral success. It's winning on the issues that matter to Republican primary voters, that matter to center right families in the state. Is that what we've seen? Because if it isn't, then maybe you want to chart a different course. And that requires different personnel, doesn't it?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I know it's not in the headlines anymore like it was during its apex with the Harvey Weinstein trial and travails. But what is the status of the Me Too movement? Just because it's on the headlines doesn't mean it's not another pernicious corner of our culture, that it's not another threat to commonsensical, decent people being canceled or whatever that means. Generally, specifically, it means being like ostracized, terminated. So the story about Frank Langella. Frank Langella. He's 84 years old. You know Frank Langella from Frost Nixon. He played Nixon.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And he's like he's a multiple Tony Award winning actor. And again, because you're accomplished doesn't mean you're immune. You're more likely to be a monster, probably. That's what we've seen from so many of these people that have been targeted for Me Too crimes over the last couple of years. But he provides details here. He was fired by Netflix. He was performing in a Netflix production of Fall of the House of Usher. And here's what he said happened. On March 25th, I was performing a love scene with the actress playing my young wife. Both of us were fully clothed. I was sitting on a couch. She was standing in front of me. The director called cut. He touched my leg, said the actress.
Oh, my God.
That was not in the blocking. She then turned and walked off set, followed by the director and the intimacy coordinator.
Oh, I want that job. Is that like the new Common Day Fluffer?
Well, yeah, you certainly, no, not exactly.
Intimacy coordinator.
Well, yeah, you have to.
I wanted to be continuity director, but now I think I want that role.
Sure, you want to have a, you want to tell people, you know, put your junk there and you put your thing there. Okay. So they walked off stage.
Yes.
He writes, does Langella. I attempted to follow, but was asked to give her, quote, give her some space. Mm-hmm. I waited for approximately an hour and then was told she was now returning to the set and we were wrapped. By his own admission, he said that, the instruction by the set's intimacy coordinator where he should place his hand was he didn't follow it. But he said it was a love scene on camera. Legislating the placement of hands, to my mind, is ludicrous. It undermines instinct and spontaneity. An HR rep told Langella to refrain from trying to contact the actress or the intimacy coordinator or anyone at else at Netflix. And then he was fired. Netflix said of his firing, in response to his imploring them to understand his hand misplacement wasn't his intention. It was, you know, a love scene in the context. But, you know, and again, here, this is not like a, you know, a private moment. He cajoled or through some artifice got a starlet in his hotel room a la Weinstein.
He accidentally touched her leg after a love scene and they're fully clothed.
And they're performing in front of everybody. Right. I mean, it's a production. But anyway, Netflix said, this is just an interesting line. Intention is not our concern. Netflix deals only with impact.
Oh, God. I'm so sick of Netflix.
Intention is not our concern. Netflix deals only with impact. There were other allegations against him. Of course, there were. One, he told an off-color joke. Two, sometimes he called me babe or honey. He's 84 years old.
84, please.
Three, he'd give me a hug or a touch on the shoulder.
Oh, my God.
Here's what a producer told Langella about those charges. And I guess a producer told him prior to his termination, he can't do that. Langella said he was instructed in the following manner, quote, you can't joke, you can't compliment, you can't touch, it's a new order. You can't joke, you can't compliment, you can't touch, it's a new order. Boy, if that isn't a nice summation in a few short sentences of the last several years, isn't it?
And what was the name of the Netflix series going to be? Or is it still going on?
It's an Edgar Allan Poe remake of Fall of the House of Usher. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Me Too still a thing where you work? Are you under the Netflix protocol of you can't joke, you can't compliment, you can't touch, it's a new order? I mean, I understand not touching, unwanted touching. I'm not a proponent of that, obviously. But I'm a proponent of touching in a love scene for the purposes of a artistic production. That seems to make sense to me.
Honestly, if they keep this up, there's going to be no more actors to perform in blockbuster films or for Netflix.
Well, it's interesting because the great Brian Cox, Brian Cox from Succession. Now he plays the patriarch on Succession. And in the Bourne movies, he's been in so many stuff. You know what's a great Brian Cox movie?
What?
As an aside. Red. If you want to see a great movie about, he's not a boy, a man and his dog, Red.
Starring Brian Cox.
Yeah, Brian Cox, great actor. He was on Piers Morgan's show recently talking about Hollywood. It's kind of a modern day McCarthyism, really. It's kind of a raid on people's sensibilities in order to reduce them and make them, I don't know, there's just so much hypocrisy in the whole thing. He continued, I'm not religious, but there's a thing in the Bible where it says, let he or she without sin cast the first stone. Thank you for that. And there seems to be a lot of casting stones, and it's like a virus. Yeah. The interesting that, he's 75 years old. He's an accomplished actor. There's nothing you can do to Brian Cox at this point, but there's a lot of people. There's nothing you can
say that, and then.
Well, there's a lot of people. There's a lot of people in position where you think there's nothing they can do, and they still don't do it anyway. They still don't step up and say what's true anyway. So, you know, any sort of utterance from inside these castles is always useful. And again, I don't know the veracity of these allegations, but I mean, it's still, Fred Savage just got knocked out.
Really?
Little Fred Savage.
For what?
Same thing. Me too. Fired after an investigation into a number of complaints, of alleged misconduct in his role as executive producer of the relaunch of The Wonder Years. Well, Little Fred Savage, remember in the bed with Peter Falk and Princess Bride? little Fred Savage.
You can't do a remake of Wonder Years without Fred Savage.
Apparently you can, or ABC's going to try.
Well, they shouldn't try.
Uh-huh.
Who else is on the list? When's Kevin Spacey coming back?
It's interesting, too. Well, that's, I mean.
That's a difference. But still.
Me Too allegations are false, clearly. This is interesting, too. This was noted that he's been targets of the complaints in the past. Allie Mills, who played Savage's mom in the original Wonder Years, claimed in 2018 a sexual harassment lawsuit from a costume designer against Savage. And and the guy who played his older brother, Jason Hervey, ended the show. The suit was later settled and dropped. There's some other things that, you know, like allegations of being mean and this sort of thing. But, so I don't know. I'm not saying somebody accusing Fred Savage. He's in a, you know, he's whatever. It's possible that Fred Savage could have done something wrong. I don't know. But it's still out there. And it's all very murky. And everybody who makes an allegation gets to be protected. And the person against whom the allegations are made gets to be skewered for sport in the court of public opinion. Something not right about that. And, I appreciate, like, Langella not going away quietly. This guy has had a great career. He's a great actor. And, he thought he was going to go out with a performance of a great piece, the Edgar Allan Poe piece. And now he's got this as an 84-year-old, and he's like, he's going to tell a story. Good. This is still a thing. Mark in Libertyville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, morning.
Morning.
And listen, you guys, and I've said this to and I've thought this, and I guess I do walk the walk that you guys, what you're talking about, I find this fascinating because we continue as a culture. This will probably be a little bit broader topic, but we continue as a culture to want to be entertained, whether it be by Hollywood movies or athletics. But in turn, these people make just enormous amounts of money. They live lives of just total gross excess. And then they use that money from millions of people wanting to be entertained for a short period of time. And they use it to promote a political platform that is completely diametrically opposed to what I believe is where the country should be. And I find it fascinating that Americans continue to even pay attention in any capacity to these people.
Well, the impact on culture, I mean, thanks for the call, Mark. I mean, and you're right. Your premise is the key, which is that, you know, most people are content with their bread and circuses. And that's just the sort of the nature of the human condition, which is why these things are such a fight, even though they seem obvious to us. Well, let's take another call. Okay. Eric in Arlington Heights.
Hi, Dan. Frank Langella was in a movie in 1970 called Diary of a Madhouse Life, and it was really good. He was a real stud back then. And this is with Richard Benjamin and Cary Snodgrass. And Richard Benjamin was emotionally abusing Cary Snodgrass, and she took up with Frank Langella. He was really a good-looking guy back then. He probably still thinks that, you know, he's the same type of guy now that he was back then, you know. But it's really good.
All right. Thanks for the call, Eric.
Or it could have just been an accident. I mean, he touched her leg.
I mean, again, this
I mean, did he go up or... it's so weird.
No. Here's the other thing, too.
This, again, takes away from real victims out there.
Well, don't you find this interesting? On the one hand, the left's promotion of Sodom and Gomorrah. I mean, on the one hand, the left so many of the left promote and live a life that approximates those of Gore Vidal's Caligula. On the other hand, they're a bunch of Puritans. You touched my leg in the wrong place during a scene. On the one hand, they promote the sexualization of children in kindergarten. And on the other hand, they're Puritans.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Will and Skokie.
Hey, how you doing? It's basically getting to the point where whatever the woman herself feels, that's reality. I mean, we see HR, the person who gets to HR first and complains is the winner. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like with the abortion debate, the decision of whether the fetus is a legal person is merely a matter of the woman's opinion. And how do you make law that way?
Well,
and the same thing with
policy.
This kind of stuff. It's all about opinion.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Well, I mean, that's why I emphasize this Netflix statement. Intention is not our concern. Netflix deals only with impact, not truth. Impact. It's a difference. Frank, Arlington Heights.
Draft day. That was my favorite Frank Langella. Another more positive topic here. One of the best sports movies there is, you know, the one with Kevin Costner about Bo Callahan. They're going to draft that quarterback, and I forget the guy they actually drafted. But
no.
That was my favorite Frank movie. You don't like it?
Yeah, it wasn't a very good sports movie. No.
I think it's up there with, I mean, I know you like Hoosiers, and
likes
Miracle,
Hoosiers.
Of course. But I love that movie. I don't know, just the choreography or all that stuff was just really good in the movie. Kevin Costner was good. So, anyway.
All right, what about Fall of the House of Usher? What do you think about that? Other topic?
I basically just get Netflix once a year when they have Ozark on. I just finished that, so I don't think I'll get Netflix ever again. So I've never seen House of Usher or any of that stuff. So.
All right. Thanks.
I'd like to
Thanks,
talk
Frank.
To you about Ozarks, but
what do you
people
want?
People out there haven't finished watching.
Yeah, I'm done with it too.
I'm done with it. It's Dan's a, done it, with it.
Don't spoil it. Don't spoil it, Frank.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Well, he was going to say something. Frank's not stupid.
Well, I would just say that I mean, it's, you know, Better Call Saul has gotten better as it's moved along, and I don't think Ozark has. I think Ozark is not. I mean, I've seen the decline in Ozark the last couple of seasons. Not as good.
Which is what usually happens. Very tough for a series to get better. Like, that's the rare series. Thanks for the call, Frank. And actually, it's two Vince Gilligan series that have gotten better as they went along. Two great series. Better Call Saul and, of course, what did it spin off of?
Breaking Bad. That was too violent for me. I had to stop watching it.
I loved it.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Wow. Wow. Natural beauty. I was doing that all weekend, telling people about your meeting with Tangerine Jesus, former President Trump. Wow.
We put his hands together. Wow.
Wow. Natural beauty. Yeah. All right.
Still trying to get him on the show. He'll call in.
You nice. Keep working on that.
I will. Thank you.
Over the weekend on the Sunday talkies, a lot of drum beating for Ukraine across the spectrum. Seth Moulton on with Brett Baer. He's a Democrat socialist from Massachusetts. He said this.
But at the end of the day, we've got to realize we're at war. And we're not just at war to support the Ukrainians. We're fundamentally at war, although it's somewhat through a proxy, with Russia. And it's important that we win.
Congressman Turner?
We're at war with Russia, although through a proxy, parenthetically. You notice
can't
how
take a
over,
vote on that to declare we're at war.
You notice how over weeks the rhetoric just keeps ratcheting up in the direction of war. It becomes more and more bellicose with each passing week. Maybe it's a function of confidence that Ukraine can repel Russia, Ukraine can win, we can deal Putin and Russia a defeat. Maybe that's it. Maybe it's something else. Lindsey Graham, on with Brett Baer and Fox News Sunday, he's tripling down. Of course he is.
You know, Putin winning is a disaster for the United States. That means he's going to move forward further in Europe. He's trying to rewrite the map of Europe. If Putin wins, then Taiwan is probably going to be invaded by China. But if Putin loses, then I think that's a great day for Europe, a great day for the United States. We need to triple down on our willingness to help the Ukraine. We need to pass a $33 billion supplemental package, $20 billion for weapons. We need to work with the International Criminal Court to gather evidence to prosecute Putin personally. We need a resolution that I have with Senator Blumenthal, a Democrat, to designate Russia as a state sponsor of terrorism. We need to put more weapons in theater that can strike the Russian military offensively. So I want to triple down on beating Putin. Burns said today, the CIA director, that Putin would double down because he can't lose in Ukraine. Well, I want to triple down because we can't let him win in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. I'll see your double and I'll make it a triple. Lindsey Graham. American Enterprise Institute's Fred Kagan. A former West Point professor, son of Donald Kagan, some people may know. He was on Bill Kristol's podcast saying much the same thing.
If the Russians are actually defeated and this war ends in a way that it's clear that the Russians have been defeated and that the West has actually held together and armed Ukraine and backed it and created a bulwark against Russian expansion, well, then the situation in Europe is transformed. Russia's role globally is transformed. And I do think that other potential aggressors look at that and go, at a minimum, we'd better make sure that our militaries are really what they say they are and are really up to the task, which, of course, may lead to sort of worse outcomes for us down the road. But I think we're at a bifurcation point in the world. And I do think that's why it's so incredibly important that we make sure to be giving the Ukrainians everything that they need actually to defeat Russia and liberate their country.
Mm-hmm. Fred Kagan, Lindsey Graham, Seth Moulton.
What does defeating Russia look like?
Let's hear from somebody or from a corner we don't hear from publicly very much because it's always interesting. I mean, I don't want to go full Dwight D. Eisenhower here, but Lockheed Martin CEO Jim Taslett was on Face the Nation, and war is their business, and according to Jim, business is getting better.
We're planning for the long run, and not just in the Javelin, because this situation, the Ukraine conflict, has highlighted a couple of really important things for us. One is that we need to have superior systems in large enough numbers, so like Javelin, Stingers, advanced cruise missiles, equipment like that. So we know there's going to be increased demand for those kinds of systems from the U.S. and for our allies as well and beyond into Asia Pacific most likely too. The second really valuable lesson was control of the airspace is really critical. So the Ukrainians are managing to control their airspace. The Russian Air Force doesn't have free rein over the entire country. And the reason that they don't is because the Ukrainians can still fly their aircraft and they also have a pretty effective integrated air and missile defense system. So products and systems like F-16, F-35, Patriot missiles, THAAD missiles, we know that there's going to be increased demand for those kinds of equipment too, because the threat between Russia and China is just going to increase even after the Ukraine war.
We're planning for the long run, says Lockheed Martin CEO. For more on all this, pleased to be joined for our weekly chat with Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano for our weekly chat. Vice President of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation, author of the book Brutal War, Jungle Fighting in Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, you know, I have to be honest with you. A lot of this to me sounds like amateur hour, and it gets, you know, back to one of the, I think, the fundamental problems that we've seen since this started, which is I think we're in a new kind of war. If you look at what Russia and China and Iran want to do, they want a world without America. They're coming after us. I never liked the term Cold War to begin with because, first of all, we had two major wars right in the middle of it, and lots of people fought and died in this. So, you know, pretending that somehow, you know, confronting your enemies, nobody gets hurt is kind of nonsense anyway. But serious people, when they look at this, they recognize you don't treat every problem equally, right? And so we had this taxonomy of, you know, vital interests, things that we're actually, as an American, lives out to fight and defend that are important to us. Vital interests, things that we're going to help out, right? But they don't rise to the putting American troops on the line. And then the other kinds of interests that we support and everything. You know, we don't hear that. I mean, one of the great flaws of this administration is, you know, we've never heard a real serious explanation of the American people. What are we doing and why are we trying to do it? And just listening to some of these voices, there's an awful lot of loose talk. You know, first of all, we're not fighting a proxy war in Ukraine. A proxy war is when you go and you find a proxy and you have them go and attack somebody for you. We're helping Ukrainians defend themselves because it's in our interest to do so. Also, we're not fighting a war against Russia. We're helping the Ukrainians defend themselves, which is a legitimate purpose, and two, is important because Putin's interests don't stop at the Ukraine. He wants to destabilize Western Europe. He wants America to be lowered. That's exactly what the Chinese wanted. But a lot of what you hear is, you know, very bellicose, very over the top, and it doesn't clearly define American interests and strike that balance between what's appropriate and right for us to do and what are actually goals that we're trying to achieve. Trying to accomplish.
Well, I got to tell you, I mean, yeah, you're responding to what Seth Moulton said, the Democrat from Massachusetts. I mean, he's a former Marine Corps officer. I mean, he's a Harvard Business School guy. He's smart. He's served. He's done he's served tours, and good for him, and we appreciate his service. But
right.
That's what he's saying, proxy war, and we're at war with Russia. What is he? I mean, I know you're saying he doesn't understand, but that's sort of disquieting.
Sure, he does understand. Sure, he was trained on this stuff when he was in the Marine Corps. But the reality is people are not acting. And you know, this is serious. You remember your mom said, you know, it's all fun games till somebody loses an eye. So this is a serious stuff now, and people should act that way. You know, another story that enraged me was this, you know, leaking about, well, yeah, we helped them do that. You know, from the Pentagon, of like leaking operational intelligence in the middle of a conflict. Unbelievably unprofessional. You know, these are things which are just not appropriate because we are in serious times trying to do serious things. And then you have people kind of really just, to be honest with you, just running in their mouth.
And we have more new sanctions. Is that going to do anything? Because it's not working
so far.
Well,
you know, we talked about sanctions before. Sanctions are a tool. They're not a strategy. But mostly what they do is limit the resources that are valuable to your adversary and makes them make hard choices, which is fine. But that doesn't get you to the end of the day. You know, what I don't hear from this administration, this is where I'm really worried, and, you know, we have a lot of fair-weather patriots now. Because the Ukrainians are doing well, all of a sudden their ambitions are, well, let's defeat the Russian army.
Yes.
Let's, you know, drive them into the sea. This is nonsense. Let's be serious. Serious to me would be the President of the United States getting on airwaves and saying, let me tell you how we're going to get America to energy independence, energy dominance, how we're going to produce reliable, affordable, dependable energy for every American and for our friends and allies. When they make that speech, that's what I'll know they're serious about this country.
Speaking to this victory talk, there's a lot of reading of tea leaves and parsing of statements going on. Holman Jenkins writing in the Wall Street Journal about how badly he thinks it's going for Russia from his perspective, and there's certainly some evidentiary support. He writes, listen to the statements or tweets of his most Western-facing servants, Putin's that is, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, Dmitry Medvedev. They don't bother suggesting the war isn't a disaster for Russia, only that it can become a disaster for the West, too. Is that a fair read on where Russia thinks they are?
Well, yeah. So I think that it is. So there's kind of two wars going on. One is the Russian war in the public sphere, where their statements are getting, you know, even more crazy and aggressive. But actually, on the ground, the Russians are actually getting more conservative, and it seems, because, you know, Putin has a difficult choice. He doesn't want to lose. He can't lose. How embarrassing that would be. But on the other hand, if he expands the mobilization throughout the country, starts conscription, that really brings the war home to Russians. And I don't think they want to risk that either. So he's kind of caught in a space where he can't afford to lose, but escalating for him is very, very dangerous. Now, having said that, again, this hubris is just completely misplaced. Okay, this isn't the best of all worlds for Vladimir Putin, but he owns more territory in Ukraine than he ever did. He has over somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million Ukrainians hostage. He is continuing to flatten this city every day. And he is, look, it's not a free lunch for us either. I mean, we're paying Ukrainians to fight this war. It's also costing him about $1 billion a day. Sorry, but I just think, you know, people that think that just Putin's on the ropes and the whole thing's going to collapse. This is a dangerous man. We should be taking him seriously. We should not be saying ridiculous things. But to me, it's just a sign that we are in dangerous times with Iran and China and Russia. And when I hear this kind of aggressive talk, that to me is a sign that people aren't taking it seriously anymore if they try to ignore it and say, hey, not our problem.
He is Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano. We appreciate him fighting through his allergies.
Yes,
the great ones always play hurt. I mean, that's just what we know. Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
That wasn't too bad. Just a couple of coughs.
Yeah. Thanks.
All right, see you guys.
Thanks. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, you know how Bill Gates has this new book out, How to Prevent the Next Pandemic, which is basically a promotion of the lockdowns and all the mitigation efforts, but you got to do it faster and...
Oh, really? That's the solution?
And with a little bit more communist flair.
Just because you have money doesn't mean you're smart and he should butt out of health issues.
Well, here's the thing. Listen to this characterization from Bill Gates of what transpired over the last 2 years. Fascinating, given all that he said during that time.
It wasn't until early February when I was in a meeting that experts at the foundation said, there's no way, you know, there's been too much travel without diagnosis for us to contain this. And then at that point, we didn't really understand the fatality rate. You know, we didn't understand that it's a fairly low fatality rate and that it's a disease mainly of the elderly, kind of like flu is,
really?
Although a bit different than that.
We have come to
so that was a pretty scary period,
right?
Where the world didn't go on alert, including the United States, nearly as fast as it needed to.
Oh, wow. Really?
So what, preemptive lockdowns next time? Just stay locked down. An amazing characterization of what we know to be true, since he was denying effectively it was true in support of all these futile lockdown and mitigation efforts over the last 2 years. Now, all of a sudden, we didn't learn until whenever I said, I guess right now in real time, that it was a low fatality, mainly the elderly. I thought we were all equally at risk. I thought we were all in the same boat. I thought we could contain it, you know, slow the spread and protect our hospitals through lockdowns. And now he's saying we knew in February that it was not containable. It was too late. But he supported those policies anyway.
Why?
And what did they accomplish? There's not much of an assessment there. And his prescription is, for the next one, more of the same. Just do it, as I said, earlier and bigger.
And I got to tell you, CBS, did you watch 60 Minutes last night? Because they interviewed kids who are suicidal, mental health issue and that mental health aspect. But at the beginning, they said, well, we already had a mental health issue before the pandemic. No, because everybody that they interviewed was because of the pandemic. So nice try.
And it's not because of the pandemic. It's because of our response to the pandemic. All this COVID did this and COVID did that. No.
It was the response.
No, we did this.
It was a lockdown. And it was Democratic mayors and Democratic governors that did it to these kids. And it's life experiences that they can't get back. And these kids, they're going to be screwed up for a long, long time.
And some Republicans. And there should be a reckoning across the board that knows no political affiliation.
Yeah, I tweeted it out if you guys want to see it. It's on Amy Jacobson. So just so you know.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm before Senate committee last week being questioned by Kansas Senator Roger Marshall, that's Dr. Marshall to you, to about energy independence, oil and gas industry.
You do not believe any of your policies have impacted the supply of oil and gas in this country.
Nor does the CEOs of the oil and gas industries, 94% of whom have said that the failure to produce more have nothing to do with the policies of government.
Yeah, I would argue that point, and I think most Americans would as well. I grew up in the oil and gas industry. I'm still connected to it. And those folks are afraid to invest because of your policies. Your over-aggressive policies. And I just hope that your economists would stop and take responsibility that that the decreased supply in this country is what has led to the increased price, and your policies are responsible for that.
All the oil companies see a fascinating position for Jennifer Granholm and the administration to take. All the oil companies say our policies have nothing to do with the reduction in production.
And hence the increase of prices at the pump.
Well, wait a second. I thought you wanted to own it. Say, you're damn right our policies have had an impact on the oil and gas companies. You're dang right they did, because we want them gone. We're replacing them. So, of course, our policies have had an impact. Why don't you own it? Because they know they can politically. But in terms of what oil and gas company CEOs are saying, I mean, Jenna Granholm is just making stuff up. It's just the want to do. We've played any number of oil and gas energy executives over the last 2 months since this energy price spike metastasized. Give you an example. Here's Claire Chase, Mac Energy, back in March.
It's just been really difficult to understand what President Biden has been thinking since the day that he took office. I mean, as we look at his actions, he went ahead and banned Keystone Pipeline almost immediately, and signaled that he was going to make it more difficult for us to drill by putting a hold on federal leases, by doing a number of things, but then going ahead and agreeing with Nord Stream 2. So it's interesting today. I mean, this is a crisis of President Biden's making. If he had allowed us to continue to drill the way that we were under President Trump, I don't think we'd be seeing $130 oil today.
That doesn't sound like absolution from the oil and gas industry executives that Jennifer Granholm was referencing, does it? For more on all things energy policy and environment related, pleased to be joined again by Bjorn Lomborg. He's the president of the Copenhagen Consensus Think Tank, author of the book False Alarm, How Climate Change Panic Cost Us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet. Bjorn, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Dan, it's great to be back.
Sort of confused rhetoric you hear from the West there, on the one hand, they are in a suicide pact with the IPCC. On the other hand, they have domestic politics that they have to address. And so they're speaking in a forked-tongued manner, like you heard from Granholm. We want to eliminate these industries. We're not doing anything negative to negatively impact these industries.
Yeah. I mean, it really shows the dilemma that we're talking about. Look, global warming is a real problem. And if you want to fix it the way that most people are talking about fixing it today, it requires you to have much higher costs on fossil fuels. It's very simple, as you also just outlined. You want basically to push people away from fossil fuels and towards these less reliable, more costly technologies like solar and wind and others. But of course, once you start seeing that happening, it doesn't pay off politically. It's actually really, really unpopular. And so you try all kinds of ways to say, well, actually, that was not what we wanted. What it really shows us that you can never successfully decarbonize and solve global warming by promising to make fossil fuels so expensive nobody can afford them, because you will never get the public policy and the majorities to pull that through. Not in the rich countries, and certainly not in China, India, Africa, where they quite frankly have other and more important priorities like pulling their populations out of poverty.
Well, don't you think they want to raise the gas prices so high that you're forced to buy an electric car at some point in time or a hybrid vehicle?
Well, I mean, Obama was, you know, actually accidentally, I think, said that, honestly, back in 2008, that, you know, his policies inevitably would make electric prices skyrocket. I also think they recognize that's just not doable. And so you have this situation where they're at one side saying, yes, we should raise prices. And there is an academic argument for increasing prices and putting on carbon tax. But you also just need to recognize, unless you can actually get people to join in on this, you'll never succeed. And that's exactly what we're learning now. Nobody wants to pay huge costs for electricity or any other energy form. And so instead of focusing on making fossil fuels so expensive that nobody wants them, we have to focus on innovating green energy down so much so that it becomes cheaper than fossil fuels. If we could innovate, you know, say fourth generation nuclear power to be cheaper than fossil fuels, everyone would switch, not just rich, well-meaning Americans, but also the Chinese, the Indians, and the Africans.
Does the UN, do they understand that most regular people in the world, including in the West, believe they have about the same self-awareness as some TikTok bimbo when they issue these pronouncements through reports like they did last month? That humanity is on a spiral of self-destruction. The latest, the sky is falling pronouncement from the UN that we've had to endure 50 years of these things and the dire predictions that don't come true. And then they just continue to double and triple down. I mean, do they get the fact, do they understand that nobody's listening, or do we just not appreciate that their audience isn't us? It's just policymakers that will then do the ugly work and the heavy lifting of imposing these sort of world governance mandates on free people like in America.
I can't speak to the mindset of the UN. I think they really think they're a force for good. Of course, they also, you know, want to be someone who actually succeeds. And there's a lot of other things that are not succeeding. Like, for instance, their main job is to keep the peace in the world. And that's obviously not working out very well right now. So they also focus a lot on climate. Now, again, climate is a real problem. So it's a good thing that they focus on it. It's bad that they often sensationalize it and sometimes just make, you know, really, really stupid pronouncements. The one that you just mentioned that came out, I believe, a week and a half ago from the UN, basically saying we have more and more catastrophes. And it's important to recognize the way they measure that is simply by going back in the 1970s and see how many disasters did we count back then and how many disasters do we count now. And not surprisingly, we count a lot more because we have a world where everybody has a cell phone. You notice every little thing that happens. And the researchers tell us this. They say, don't use the data to say that there's an increase, because all of this is an increase in better registering. But the UN just goes ahead and says, this is why we're seeing many, many more catastrophes. No, it's just simply an artifact of the data. And then they go on, and this was just unbelievable. They say they also kill more and more people. Well, actually, when you look at the climate-related deaths, so floods, droughts, storms, and extreme temperatures, they've actually declined dramatically. Just get this. Over the last 100 years, these deaths have declined 99%. How astounding is that? And yet they could tell us it's increased. Do you know how they made it increase? Because they counted COVID in 2020. Huh. Yes.
What?
COVID is more than all the people that died from all other disasters in the world over the last 50 years. Yes, of course, you can tweak the data that way, but it's not a good way to inform people.
Well, and you've written about this, and we've talked about this before, too. One of the reasons is because of things like better construction and technology that's provides better prediction on significant storms, you know, so you get a more advanced warning and those sorts of things, right?
Exactly. I mean, the simple point is, when you're rich, you're much more resilient. You tackle things better. You have air conditioning. You also have heat to fix cold deaths. And this is why a hurricane that hits Florida creates lots of damage, because Florida is a rich place, but it typically kills a few people. The same storm that hits Guatemala will wipe out their economy and kill thousands or tens of thousands of people. And that's why, if you actually want to help people, the first thing you want to do is to get them out of poverty. This is not rocket science. In some sense, this ought to be what the UN wanted to do. I think it's also what they'd like to do, but they just end up being so much lured into this climate conversation and saying climate is the biggest thing and this is what we should really worry about. And of course, the problem is if we end up only focusing on climate, we end up making energy more expensive, we end up slowing poverty declines, and we make the world worse for a lot of people, at least in short and medium term.
Well, the other thing, too, is they don't even listen to their own people, so why should we listen to them? The UN World Food Program had David Beasley. He said, like, at the within a few months of the pandemic, said, do not cut off the supply lines, because if you do that, if you lock down and disrupt our supply lines and the global supply lines for moving things like food around to people who need it, you're going to move the needle from 10 million people on the cusp of starvation to 30 million. And what did we do? What did they do? What did they advocate? All these world government organizations, UN, WHO, all these Western leaders, they locked down and they cut off the supply lines.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's very similar. I don't know if you saw the World Economic Forum, the rich guys that gather in Davos every year.
Oh, yeah.
In Switzerland. They actually, just before the Russian bombing started in Kiev, they actually voted. They asked everyone, what is the most severe risk on a global scale over the next 10 years? Imagine Putin having 200,000 people right around Ukraine. They might be, saying peace, stability, invasions in Ukraine. No, they said the most severe risk over the next 10 years is climate action failure. It just speaks of this total disconnect between what's actually happening in the world and what a lot of well-meaning people say and believe they're, rewarded to say, namely that climate is the biggest problem. Look, climate is a real problem. It, like many other things, it's something we need to fix. But making it this hyperbole, making the top of the thing that everybody should be, wildly concerned about, actually makes kids scared and makes our policies really ineffective.
Well, and it's also the hubris, which we see across so many issues, too. It's that, we can bend a virus to our will. We can bend nature to our will. Yes, if there's sensible things that we can do in a balanced way that considers the opportunity costs, then great. Everybody wants to be a good steward of the environment. But their hubris in thinking that these guys, in a room in Davos or on the IPCC, on some IPCC panel, can bend Mother Nature to their will is off-putting, to say the least.
And I think it's even more than that. It's the fact that we sort of, because we're so worried, we ignore the easy wins. We ignore the fact that we could help poor people much, much better by opening up markets, by encouraging free trade, and by making sure that they have lots and lots of energy. And likewise, that we don't invest in research and development in green energy, so we eventually get smarter policies. But also, and simply, that we don't focus on the things that would actually have a huge impact right now. Like, for instance, if we worry about storms and droughts and heat waves, why don't we make sure that poor people especially are well attuned, that is that they're resilient, which means that they're not in poverty. These are simple things. Why is it that's not our top priorities?
Mm. Bjorn Lomborg, president of the Copenhagen Consensus Think Tank, author of False Alarm, How Climate Change Panic Costs Us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet. Bjorn, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great to talk to you guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So a lot of pro-abortion protesters out and about this weekend, some making their way to outside of the homes of Justices Roberts and Kavanaugh in the D.C. area. Others at pro-life offices around the country or Catholic churches where they vandalized or worse in Madison at the Wisconsin Pro-Life Office, attempted to set fire to it.
Yeah, and wrote a nice note there, which scribbled on the building saying pretty much, you know, if you're going to eliminate abortion, you're on notice.
If abortion is not safe, you're not safe.
Oh, yeah. Nice threat there.
You know, it's all also overstated, though, the way the media covers it. It's in most of the places, it's a few dozen. Maybe you get into 100 or 200. The idea that it's like some groundswell. The nation's women are in revolt over this leaked draft opinion of Alito. Hardly. But some of them are women and pee hats and so forth. The whole assemblage of the left, like those in front of the homes of Roberts and Kavanaugh.
Abortion safe and legal. You don't care if people die. You don't care if people die. You don't care if people die.
Pro-life is a lie. You don't care if people die. Nicely rehearsed. From the people who brought you pigs in a blanket, fry them like bacon.
Oh, yeah, the same group.
Yeah.
And they all had masks on outdoors protesting.
Certainly the same songwriter, I presume. Yeah. Here is one woman who was interviewed as to why she was at this protest outside the home of the homes of those two justices.
And what's your name, ma'am?
Nikki Enfield.
And why are you here today?
This is bullshit. You don't get to take away our bodily autonomy and enjoy your Saturday night at home. You get to do one or the other.
And what does it mean to you to be marching
big
to the justices'
homes? I'm going
to
get you.
This is personal, so we're going to take it to the personal space.
Okay.
They did this, not us.
I get to see you. This is personal space.
Clarence Thomas waded in on the topic, saying that during a judicial conference in Atlanta on Friday, we're becoming addicted to wanting particular outcomes, not living with the outcomes we don't like. We can't be an institution that can be bullied into giving you just the outcomes you want. The events from earlier this week, referring to the leak and the response, are a symptom of that, he said. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Rusty Reno, editor at First Things, firstthings.com. Rusty, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Pleasure to be with you.
You reacted last week to the leak of that draft opinion, and I'm sure you were unsurprised by everything that ensued following that leak.
Well, certainly the protests. There's a whole network of well-funded organizations that, you know, can put people out into the streets. I think I read somewhere about organizations providing stipends, guaranteeing that they would pay for bail and so on and so forth. So it kind of repeats the Black Lives Matter summer of discontent, where I think in retrospect we can see that a lot of the protest is really confected, you know, created by a nonprofit sphere on the left that's funded actually by billionaires who have a big investment in the system. It's kind of a crazy setup, but that seems to be the society we have at this point.
Well, and it's choreographed too, right? So you have those groups that are funded, like you say, deploying their foot soldiers, and then you have the politicians before the cameras trying to incite them for the purposes of revving up their base the same way they did during the summer of discontent that was brought to you by Black Lives Matter.
Yep. So I'm not at all surprised by this. You know, and I think, and you said earlier, it's really, these are not significant numbers of people. So it's the kind of hardcore activist base.
Now, over the weekend, Nina Totenberg from NPR said that the leak was came from a conservative judge, a clerk from a conservative judge. Do you have any idea where this leak came from?
No, I haven't the slightest idea. You know, I think, you know, we need to be open-minded about where it might have come from. I think the incentives are strongly suggest that it was a, you know, progressive clerk, or even, you know, hard to know exactly. With encouragement from the, you know, the progressive establishment in D.C. But, you know, Nina Totenberg may be right, but I don't think nobody knows at this point. Well, the leaker knows, I suppose the people at Politico know, but it's going to be, we may not find out. It could be like Watergate, where, you know, decades go by before the truth is of who the deep throat was actually revealed.
The reaction to the leak, and particularly from people suggesting the importance of promulgating the opinion, the importance of finding the leaker to preserve the integrity of the institution and so forth, is that a real thing even at this point, or is that just so much performative pearl clutching? I mean, do these institutions have legitimacy among a wide swath of the population, except when they do things that particular constituencies desire to see done?
You know, I think that I certainly have for decades thought Roe was a stain on our society, and it was a wrongly decided decision. But I did not question the desire of the Supreme Court to follow the law as best they see it. I think that was a mistaken decision, but it didn't, it didn't undermine the legitimacy of our judicial system. What does undermine the legitimacy of the judicial system is not mistakes. I mean, every human makes them. And I think hopefully this Alito opinion will prevail and will correct that mistake in our society, and it'll be for the best that we don't have a constitutional right to kill people. But what does undermine institutions is to corrupt their procedures and processes. And I don't think listeners can really overestimate how important confidentiality is in the judicial process. So the leaker, if it was a clerk, the clerk has a duty, I mean, as a lawyer, to his client. His client is the justice. And so Alito's, lawyer-client privilege, I mean, that sort of person could never be trusted to be a lawyer in our society. They would violate the confidence of their client. And, of course, to violate the confidence of the public. I mean, we all want to sustain our institutions. And so one of my friends who was a clerk on the Supreme Court says, you could use the T word, treason. It was a treasonous act. He was very angry. He's very opposed to capital punishment. But he thought in this case, maybe he's willing to.
He is very upset. But I mean, so, you write about the left's total war mentality in First Things. And that total war mentality has a tendency to generate escalation. So we're in charge. It's a purge. We're not in charge. We're trying to tear down the institution. You're in charge. Then, it's almost their hope is that conservatives, if to the extent they're in charge or they have a majority for a fleeting moment of time, it's almost they want something that to them looks like or feels like or they can characterize as a purge because it just feeds the total war mentality they bring to every issue all the time.
I see this as a sign of weakness, not strength. I mean, you can be magnanimous when you're powerful, and when your position is threatened, is when you tend to fight. It's the cornered animal sort of mentality. And so I think what we're seeing here is that, in my lifetime, when I was younger, the liberal establishment really was in a super dominant position. Of course, the Reagan Revolution changed things, but, in the Clinton administration, the era of big government's over. And the liberal establishment adjusted and regained regained a great deal of control. And certainly it controls our cultural and media and so on. And so insofar as it's being threatened by those of us who actually don't like the society that we've created over the last generation, homelessness, drug abuse, decline in marriage, 20-25% of young people on some kind of psychiatric drugs. I mean, these are all warning signs that the society that progressives have insisted was going to make our lives better is actually making it worse. And so there's an increasing rebellion. And so you see it with, censorship on social media. These are all efforts to maintain control in an environment where the progressive establishment is losing control.
And
I think this is just another example of it, the leak. Unable to control the outcome, they're going to, use other extra legal means to try to control it. Just as unable to win a public debate, they're going to censor what we're allowed to say on Facebook.
Yeah. And what about their pushing of the pronouns? I mean, there's 75 now different pronouns that people can use, and even a hashtag. That's a pronoun.
It all started with Prince turning into a symbol. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we need to be strong here and not capitulate. It's really a question of truth telling. I want to be polite. I don't want to create problems for people, but I should not be forced to lie about reality. And I think this is where we are as a society. And it's going to take some strong will on our part to resist. But I do think that that's an important service that we have to give to our fellow citizens, to have the courage to say, well, actually, no.
Yeah. Well, and
they yeah. is not a singular pronoun.
Yeah, right. And also, too, I mean, something you said, which it bears repeating, because you can let the left pull you down into their level, if you will. That is, when the revolts do happen and they're successful, then restraint and magnanimity are required so that you don't become what you abhor.
Sure. I mean, I think there's I think all of us find ourselves in situations where we just hold our tongue. You know, we don't have to be saying things all the time. But there's a difference between being polite and certain topics up because you know that the person disagrees with you, versus being forced to actually pretend that you agree. And this is what I'm hearing from friends, especially
right.
in Fortune 500 companies,
right.
you know, diversity seminars, all those things, where you don't just you're not allowed to just sit in silence. You're actually compelled to, make your loyalty oath. And this is what's intensifying, I think, the cultural conflict. People think people on the right are the provocateurs in the cultural war. But I think we look back and know it's the left that's just constantly, relentlessly, as you use the term, escalating. I think we need to give some long thought as a society how to de-escalate. And part of it is to, decriminalize. I think a lot of whether it's hostile work environment principles or these sorts of things can be used. I mean, Title IX is now used as a progressive weapon against conservative professors. So smarter people than I am, who have a good legal background, need to think through how to take some of these nuclear weapons out of the hands of the left.
He is Rusty Reno, editor at First Things, firstthings.com. Rusty, thanks as always.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Because they got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat. Yeah, the campus beat.
Yeah, Dan and Amy. Wow. Natural beauty.
Stop at 7.
We'll start with a couple of local high schools and then level up to Harvard. Forget that beating of that freshman girl in the hallways at Lyons Township High School. Real hate crime has been committed.
Oh, no. What now?
A tampon dispenser installed in the boys' bathroom has been ripped down and stuffed in a toilet.
Did I not tell you that was going to happen? Boys don't need tampons in their restrooms.
You've never heard of the term menstruating?
Menstruation.
Menstruating.
Sometimes I get the cramps real bad.
Mm-hmm.
What movie was that from again?
State Representative Barbara Hernandez, Democrat from Aurora, good friend of Richard Irvin.
Oh, who, by the way, is having a press conference to discuss body cameras only.
Well, maybe he'll tackle some questions about menstruation. This is really important for young menstruators. Quote. She said,
okay.
State Representative Barbara Hernandez, Democrat from Aurora, ally of Richard Irvin. This is very important, really important for young menstruators to have these tampon dispensers in the boys' bathroom. Some boy perhaps didn't think so, and now a hate crime has been committed. And I don't know if they'll suspend Heaven Washington or expel her for the beating of that freshman girl, even after she's been arrested for
battery.
Misdemeanor or battery. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you can bet if this culprit is found, OPRF.
Yeah, because guess what? This just in. Guys don't want to see that in their bathroom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well.
They're going to use them as little rocket ships.
That's state law, sister.
Well, you don't got to tell me, girlfriend.
Oak Park River Forest High School. Restroom in on the second floor, I guess.
But they have pads and tampons?
No, vandalism at the restroom.
Oh.
Someone scribbled the N-word and a swastika on a bathroom stall.
Mm-hmm.
Racial slur and anti-Semitic graffiti on a wall as well. Found in a second floor boys' bathroom on Friday. And CBS 2 Chicago was on the story. Director of the Simon Wiesenthal Center. We're seeing this in many schools. Human rights for all people. It doesn't make a difference who you worship if you worship who you love. Yet we know. I get it. The question is, she also said we're going to speak to the superintendent because it's not the first incident in the school. No. How's that going on at OPRF? That is Die Central. That is Die Base Camp. Diversity, Inclusion, Equity Base Camp. They're the ones that do the black students only assemblies.
Oh, that's right. Right. Remember that one?
Yeah. What's going on there? Hate at OPRF? No.
Hate has no home here.
I wonder who is the propagator of the hate. Could it be another one of these misdirection plays, hate crime hoax? Could it be girls and boys, men and women of the left? Is that more likely than not? Yes, it is.
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line. 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Where do they get these ideas? Well, you know, maybe starting at about 2 years old when they are instructed on the particulars of race from the book Our Skin.
Our Skin.
Our Skin. New one you can look out for in addition to all of the other racist literature that has been infused into pre-K through 12 curricula. Our Skin, penned by Harlem activist Megan Madison and a Brooklynite and library worker. Oh, there you go, library. There's a red flag. Jessica Rally begins with a simple discussion of skin tones, then offers this, again, starting with two-year-olds. A long time ago, way before you were born, a group of white people made up an idea called race. They sorted people by skin color and said that white people were better, smarter, prettier, and that they deserve more than everybody else. Then it goes on to say, this isn't true or fair at all, exclamation point, with a picture of a white dude, honky, holding up the most beautiful skull. What? This is aimed at 2 to 5 year olds and has been distributed to at least one Manhattan kindergarten, one in Staten Island, as well as one in Brooklyn. And it's part of the new Universal Mosaic curriculum in New York City. New York City. So if it's in New York City, it's coming to Chicago if it's not already here. And then it's coming to the suburbs if it's not already there. Some parents are getting wind of this, not too keen on it. One Brooklyn parent, Vito Labella, the page alone in my mind is just preaching hate and thinks the book should be removed on that basis alone. But hate... I thought hate has no home in K through 12 education, the government run schools with all of these die personages and woke teachers union apparatchiks and super educated superintendents. How could this be going on at places like LTHS and OPRF and in the New York City school system? I'm confused. Greg in Jefferson Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning, guys. I was at a graduation for Dominican University yesterday, speaking of Oak Park, just west of there, and they gave a honorary PhD to some woman who is now in charge of whatever, I don't know, and she gave a speech. My sister and I walked out about halfway through it about, you know, how America is a racist country, systemic racism, you know, we took the land away from the Indians. I mean, one thing after another, and what I found extremely disturbing is when they introduced this woman, about, you know, half the graduates are all clamping and hooting and hollering about, you know, you could see that they thought this person is really great. And, you know, it's just really disturbing to see this going on, and these kids are being indoctrinated. I wouldn't send a kid to college for all the tea in China now.
Thanks for the call, Craig. Greg, excuse me. And that's a perfect segue to Harvard.
Yeah. I don't know.
Where does this come from? Where's the source of the hate? Oh, they're so concerned. Simon Wiesenthal Center director, so concerned about what I suspect is some canned anti-Semitic graffiti vandalism at OPRF. Right. Because that's what's happening. It's white people, honkies, are going after people of color and Jewish kids. Uh-huh. Is that what's happening? Dara Horn, writing at Barry Weiss's Substack. Dara Horn is a former editor of the Harvard Crimson. That's the newspaper at school on campus there. And recently, the Harvard Crimson endorsed the BDS movement. This has long been a staple of leftist hate-filled politics on campus and elsewhere, but particularly on campus, the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement against the state of Israel. There's some art that's been erected on campus there. Oh.
She loves seeing it.
The opening panel is art consisted, and reading from her review, Dara Horn. The opening panel's art consists entirely of large words which read, wait for it, Zionism is racism, settler, colonialism, white supremacy, apartheid. She notes parenthetically, even the UN gave up Zionism is racism, a moldy Soviet slogan the USSR spent decades promoting to its client states in the developing world. But not Harvard. Not Harvard. Can we get anybody from the ADL, Miss Pure Sloven, director of Simon Wiesenthal Center? Can you chime in on this? I have more. Another panel featured a faceless police officer bearing a truncheon over the bodies of dark-skinned people behind bars with bullet wounds on their chest, their blood dripping onto an overturned American flag. The subtle image was nearly identical to memes circulated by Iranian-backed groups online. If you're too thick to get it, she writes, American police brutality, Jews' fault. Two more panels included anodyne images of doctors in a pill bottle with vaguely worded references to health. Those digging online for what this could possibly have to do with Zionism will quickly encounter long debunked lies about Israel withholding COVID vaccines and harvesting Palestinian organs, part of a centuries-old tradition in both the Christian and Islamic worlds of accusing Jews of spreading disease and killing children. Another panel went all in on Holocaust imagery, featuring gray-clad prisoners with the Palestinian flag behind Auschwitz-style barbed wire fencing, along with a boxcar train headed for a bricked-up destination marked with an Israeli flag. Was that at Oak Park River Forest? Anybody from the Wiesenthal Center? The ADL? What do you have to say to these enlightened kids, the best and the brightest, matriculating? And it's worse than that. You have any idea? She writes, does Miss Horn, I'm fortunate to know people who are doing the actual difficult, essential work of creating dialogue and political change among Israelis and Palestinians. Sometimes, often, these people criticize Israel. However, they do not erect massive propaganda billboards labeling the people with whom they are building a future as disease-spreading Nazis. They also don't throw eggs. What is she mentioning? I mentioned egg throwing because that's what happened at Rutgers University. Last month, on the Jewish community's Holocaust Remembrance Day, the brothers of the Jewish fraternity A.E. Pi were engaged in their annual tradition of reading the names of Holocaust victims when their reading was interrupted by the thumps of eggs hitting their house. Throwing eggs at the fraternity during the commemoration is also now an annual tradition, since it happened last year as well. She writes, credit the egg throwers. When it comes to Holocaust Remembrance Day, they never forget. Zing. Spitting at Jews is a newer Rutgers tradition. Inaugurated just last week when people leaving a rally advertised as Defend Al-Aqsa, Defend Palestine, made a detour in their car to stop by that same fraternity in order to shout and spit at the brothers, calling them baby killers. How about the University of Santa Cruz, the University of California, Santa Cruz, the banana slugs.
I was going to beat you. Yeah. My cousin went there. I got myself a t-shirt.
Lovely.
Very liberal up there. They hug trees.
Miss Horn spoke there a couple of months ago. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks before my visit, the school's governing board had voted down a resolution against anti-Semitism. They voted it down. And we're being lectured by the left about anti-Semitism, and that is the gateway to other kinds of bigotry. Oh, really? Well, tell us all about it. Who are the perpetrators? All those leftists in charge of all these institutions that are supposedly monitoring hate? And, oh, by the way, filtering it down to the K-12 level, and then you don't know where it's coming from? Once the students had resolved that they were not against anti-Semitism, she writes, they apparently decided they were in favor of anti-Semitism. This became clear 4 days before my visit to campus when multiple university buildings were vandalized with spray-painted images of swastikas and nooses. Bunch of conservatives at UC Santa Cruz? I don't think so. Like the one at Harvard, this art display, though somewhat more impromptu, was clearly created by people with, in the Crimson's words, passion and skill. That's how the Harvard Crimson described those artists at Harvard who erected all that anti-Semitic propaganda, agitprop. I asked the professor hosting me whether these passionate artists were students or perhaps people from the town. Wait for this. This is great.
Okay.
Oh, we definitely think they were students, said the professor hosting Miss Horn. What made her think so, I asked. Because, she explained, we found the empty spray paint cans in the recycling bin.
Oh.
There's nothing inconsistent.
A real caper to figure out, yeah.
There's nothing inconsistent. As she writes, what are your politics? Kill the Jews, save the turtles. Who's that? The people teaching your kids at OPRF and Lyons Township High School, with some exceptions, I grant you. The administrators, the DAI consultants, coordinators, the curricula makers. And then you're going to run around with this performative business about eradicating hate from the walls of OPRF. You're the purveyors of it. You're surprised by it, even if it's intended for incitement purposes only by those on the left, which, of course, that's what it is. I'll bet you dollars to donuts that's what it is. Where does it come from? White supremacists, conservative men in charge of nothing. Dara Horn's piece at Harvard, Facts Are for Losers, and Rutgers, and UC Santa Cruz, and most of the collegiate system that has now filtered down to pre-K through 12. What's happening? That's happening. And it's been happening for four decades. Sean and Darian.
Hi, Dan and Amy. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, my son's going to be a junior at Hinsdale South. We were trying to get him to go to Providence, but there's a problem with being ineligible because he went there freshman year. Anyway, my wife, she's just like we are, very conservative, very conservative-minded. She's one of only two of her fellow teachers that didn't get the vaccine and was ostracized for it. But anyway, I keep trying to tell her, these guys do not need to go to school. I'm a contractor, been in I'm a bricklayer, and you can make a good living, a very, very, very good living. So, you know, I listen to you guys all the time, and I realize how bad these colleges and universities are, and all they want to do is brainwash these kids.
Thanks for the call, Sean. And it's not you turn them into political operatives, yes, but turn them into ignorant, hate-filled people. That's what they're doing. And that's what Dara Horn, a former editor at the Harvard Crimson, is documenting. Ryan, New Lenox.
Hey, Dan and Amy, thanks for taking my call. The Campus Beat segment made me think of this. I was at a graduation for a family member recently at Rush University, and the commencement speaker, a guy called David Blumenthal, he was one of the advisors to Obama on Obamacare, was lecturing on all the systemic injustices and racism in the healthcare industry and how the health industry needs to do more to combat global warming. But the main reason for my call was actually something that the student speaker said, and these are the folks that are going to lead the next pandemic response or the next, you know, pandemic scare response. And she said something to the effect of, you know, be firm in your convictions, but you should be willing to you know, accept change if someone presents different data. But then she did a caveat to that and said, but if you still feel, you know, if someone's presented data to the contrary of your sincerely held beliefs and you still feel strongly about your position, you should firmly hold to that position. And I thought that was just the perfect summary for the last 2 years of COVID, with all the data that has been presented in contrary, you know, being in opposition to the lockdowns and the policies of the this administration and Fauci and the rest of it. You know, be so sincerely held in your convictions that even in the face of data to the contrary, keep pushing forward.
Yeah.
Keep believing if you believe it.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Ryan. It's not limited to COVID. This is the bimboification of America.
Mm-hmm.
We had those 10 rules for being a bimbo, remember, a couple weeks ago?
Right. Yeah.
Some from some TikTok influencer. And one of them was, I mean, she, you know, she's the non-political, but I mean, but this is what it is. If you believe something, then you just stick to it regardless of what's true. And she used as an example, I like to think that Stevie Wonder can see. So he can see.
Yeah.
I mean, that's basically it. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what the facts are. And I mean, the professor at Santa Cruz telling Dara Horn, who do you think? You think it was students or people from the town that spray painted all this anti-Semitic graffiti? Oh, definitely the students, because we found the spray cans in the recycling bin.
Yeah.
Does that tell you anything about priorities? We found the tools used to spread hate in the recycling bin. We're good people.
Because at least we recycled at the end.
Mike in Crown Point.
Saving Mother Earth.
Morning, guys. You know, just go back to follow the money. You look at all the school boards around the country. They're talking to local schools into taking huge amounts of grant money to put this stuff in. And, of course, politicians, be what they may, they'll take a grant to teach the kids Nazism. They don't care. They get their couple million bucks and they're happy. It's a shame.
Thanks, Mike.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.